This is The Truth with Sherwin Hughes on 101.7 The Truth, The Truth app, and 1017thetruth.com.
So tell me, Sam, what you want to do.
Welcome to Hour 2 of The Truth with me. I'm Sherwin Hughes, and I host the show called The Truth with Sherwin Hughes. There's been a unusual, I guess, redefinition of masculinity as of late. Fine with me. It's whatever. Masculinity, I suppose, some forms of it, I guess, are toxic, which men know, right? Because we all have, you know, friends and members of our family and coworkers, whatever, that can be very poisonous with some of their machismo. So a lot of that stems from heavy insecurity, where a man has to assert himself in very aggressive ways, unnecessarily aggressive ways, to show that he's actually a man. So I never saw it that way, because I've had the luxury, I'm going to call it, of being mentored by and raised by incredible men that have shown me things about the world that only they could have shown me. And that is why I think some of my perspectives don't resonate with some folks. The most masculine men, they never have to brag about it. They don't talk about what they have. They don't talk about all the women that they've slept with. Those are only insecure men, because if you are a confident man, you never have to talk about sex because you get it. You get it often. If you have, here's another example. People that have a lot of money don't brag about their money unless either they don't have it, or they're insecure about it, or they know that they don't deserve it. Rich people don't talk about money. Rich people talk about everything else. And so there has been a redefinition of masculinity. And I heard, you know, some examples of that during the DNC. Like, it's giving like so many different like life metaphors. And I love that Tim Walz was a former football coach, because a lot of us that played football know that football is an incredible metaphor for life. You know, you bleed and you sweat and you're exhausted and you have nothing left, and all you have is your teammates. You have other men that help pick you up. And the guidance, the spiritual guidance, and all the other type of just mentorship that coaches provide to wayward, potentially wayward young men is priceless. And people don't, if you've never participated in a team sport, especially one as grueling as football is, like you just don't get it. Like, those are different human beings altogether. But masculinity is, it's power. It is. And I want to explain something I said yesterday, because I think it was lost on a bunch of people. Because I posted something in the Hughes Views Facebook group. Hughes Views is the Facebook group that corresponds to this program. And I said that white people fear black people like men fear women. And then one guy was like, well, what do you mean by that? I'm like, dude, just like keep reading it. It'll make sense to you. Huh? I don't understand. Am I supposed to use your logic or mine? I'm not going back and forth with somebody that didn't understand it. But then somebody else had said, no, women, you can get raped and get harmed by men. No, the fears are not the same. So I think it was kind of lost. First, a masculine man uses his masculinity to help people. People that otherwise wouldn't get noticed, people who are suffering in silence, people who are afraid, people who feel insecure, people that are afraid. Like, a masculine man helps those people. Coach Walz, like, started an LGBTQ group for the kids in his high school because those kids were getting bullied. So he took his masculinity as the football coach and said, no, there's going to be a support group for these kids. Masculinity does that. The other thing I'll say about this, I actually have a lot to say about it, as we redefine masculinity. And I don't think a lot of men, black men in particular, they don't know how to be masculine. They think it has to be associated with aggression and being overt and being disrespectful. All that is like, why would you want to show insecurity like that? But I don't think a lot of African-American men really know how to be masculine. And so that's why a lot of them gravitate toward Donald Trump, which is the worst example, because they don't really have good examples of the confidence that masculinity is. Masculine men won't even really say much. They'll just take it all in. And then they'll strike under the cover of darkness. They don't have to be braggadocious. The other thing is, like, men that are like super insecure, here's something else about them. And I got to be honest with this, and I probably shouldn't say it, but I'm going to say it. They don't get laid. They don't. Men that get laid on a regular basis, whether it's by your wife or your girlfriend, like, men that get laid are just calmer. They're cooler. They're just much more relaxed. Men that do not get laid are dangerous. Involuntary celibate men. They're called incels. They're literally a terrorist group. Like, they kill people. They are mass shooters a lot of times. They leave manifestos. These are men that nobody wants. Nobody wants them. They don't really have many friends. They coalesce online because of their misery, because nobody wants. They've never had a girlfriend before. They've never been on a date before. A lot of them, as Donald Trump, this is Donald Trump's words, not mine, basement dwellers. And they just, their anger just gets diffused out all on the internet, and they have like groups of incels. Like, these are the guys that like hate the high school cheerleaders because the high school cheerleaders never wanted to date them. Those are very dangerous and insecure men. Now, by no means does this mean that women should just be sleeping with these men so they should be more, so they can be less dangerous, because I wouldn't recommend that either. But they don't get laid. And that's tough for a man, because you're bombarded with all of these images of beautiful women, and you look on the Instagram and you look all over the place and it's all these beautiful women, and you go out in public and you see all these beautiful women, and none of those women want these men. And that takes a toll on these men. And I feel terribly sad for them. But they're very, very dangerous. Those are always the ones who are the most insecure, the ones that don't get laid. I don't know. I could give them some advice maybe on how to get laid. They probably won't follow it. They'll still mess it up. But I know men like that. They're just, they're unwanted completely. And that hurts them internally, because they may see themselves as good and as decent, but maybe they're awkward, or maybe they never learned, you know, how to just relax and be calm and be themselves. They're always putting on a show. They're always acting. And women see through all that. And women just, they don't want them. And then they get angry at women for not wanting them. Donald Trump encapsulates them too. Angry, unwanted men that are dangerous. You want an example of what happens? Best example I could give of angry, unwanted men that don't get laid. January 6th. That's right. Because if those men were getting laid, they'd be like, I'm not going to the Capitol. I got other things that I'd rather be doing. That anger that they have. And it's just, people are taking advantage of these folks. And I feel really, really bad for them. Like, genuinely, like, I'm not making fun of them at all, because it's got to be horrible to live in a world surrounded by the incredible, beautiful women that are smart and fun and funny and motivated and driven. And none of them want you. You know, they say there's a person out there for everybody. No, it's not. It is not. Some men are just, they're unlovable because they're horrible human beings, and we got to be mindful of them because they're extremely dangerous. Now, I'm not a psychologist. I don't know how we get to them. I don't know how we change them, but there are people that are taking advantage of the misery of these unwanted men. These are always the most dangerous men. A man that lacks confidence will do anything to get it or promote the image that he has it. And those are always the men that you have to be cautious of. And we all know men like this. Obviously, some of us can't be friends with guys like this. I can't be friends with guys that don't get laid, because they obsess about sex, and it's very boring to talk about it all the time. It's just not, like, I know women probably think that guys just talk about sex all the time. No, guys are sometimes really busy working hard and going to work and working extra hours and raising their family and thinking about money and thinking about saving and thinking about investing and thinking about buying a house. Like, that's what men really think about. We're not always thinking about sex. I think women probably think about sex more than we do, but they just don't say it. I know that they do, which is fine. Think about whatever you want to think about. Because it's through all of the hard work of men and being a better human being and being helpful and being kind and being generous and being successful in a bunch of different ways, not just financially. That is what makes you an attractive man. And when men just do that, you women will want you. You don't even got to chase women. They'll come around. Just focus on what you do. Be good at what you do. Be decent. Be honest. Be hardworking. Be helpful. Use your power and your privilege as a man to help people that don't have your same power and your privilege. That is masculinity. It's not acting tough. It's not the dude with the biggest mouth. It's certainly not the dude that spends all his time in the gym. Do y'all know that that's not really attractive either? And when you go to the gym, good for you. Go to the gym. Get healthy. Do your cardio. Do your lifting of your weights. But you don't have to make it your identity, baby. You don't have to do it. You don't got to post a picture of you at the gym. You don't have to, 3 a.m. here I am back at the gym again. All right, I guess I'll start my 9-hour workout. Oh, stop it. You're overcompensating for something. Cut that out. We're redefining masculinity. And I don't know if the men that support Donald Trump have any, or they're not confident and Donald Trump makes them feel like they are somebody. Because I'm going to be honest with you. Trump is not a masculine man. Trump has a beautiful immigrant wife that doesn't want him. Have y'all ever figured that out? Have you noticed that Doug Emhoff and Kamala Harris hug and to kiss each other? Have you noticed that? That Tim Walz and his wife, Mrs. Tim Walz, they hug and they kiss each other? Show me where. Post it in the chat. Where Donald Trump and Melania are kissing each other. She don't even want to be near, dude. She didn't even support him at his own nominating convention. How do I know? Because I was there all 4 days. Trump has to pay women to sleep with him. He's not a masculine man. Trump is not. If he is wanted, he's wanted because women may think he's a celebrity or has a lot of money. He's not a masculine man. But he promotes that he is. All right, take a break. Come back. Got some stuff here. Oh, you know what I want to talk about? I got a bunch of things I want to talk about. The school board recall election. There are some more details that are coming out about it. And I'm not throwing shade at people that were involved, because I think there was really decent, honest, hardworking people that were involved in the recall election of the 4 school board members. And I think that their cause was righteous. It's just their execution was incorrect and it was misinformed, and it's going to have a reverberating effect on Black political action in the future, because there will be other opportunities for us to say, hey, you know what? Let's come together and remove some people from office who, in this new era of joyful American politics, there are people that are stuck in the old era of pessimistic and mean and negative politics. And we may want to exercise our right to remove people from office, but this effort to recall these school board directors, it was bad and it got a little bit worse. So I'm going to take a break, come back and talk about that. We're listening to The Truth with Sherwin Hughes on 101.7 The Truth. I'll be right back.
The Truth with Sherwin Hughes returns after this on 101.7 The Truth, The Truth app, and 1017thetruth.com. This is The Truth with Sherwin Hughes on 101.7 The Truth, The Truth app, and 1017thetruth.com.
So a part of every election and getting candidates on the ballot is they have to get a certain number of what we call nomination signatures. So the state assembly is 200 signatures. County board is 200. Alderperson is 200. State Senate, 400, maybe 800. Mayor, you need 1,500. County executive, you need 1,500 signatures. Now, keeping in mind there's almost a million people, 940,000 people in Milwaukee County. And you have to get 1,500 signatures, certified signatures, to get on the ballot to be county executive, to be mayor. I think even governor and president, you only need 1,500 signatures. And an elector is the only one that can sign nomination papers. I want to make sure everybody is clear on this, because at some point in time, someone may approach you, and maybe someone has in the past, has approached you to sign nomination papers for a candidate. It doesn't even mean you support that candidate. It's just you are saying that, hey, I'm at least 18 and I am eligible to vote. You don't even have to be registered to vote. You don't even have to be a voter to sign nomination signatures, to give your nomination signature. All you're saying is, hey, I'm going to give my signature and I'm going to put my address down so that this person can get on the ballot. Right. That's a fundamental part of our democracy. That's the first credibility of a campaign. Can they get at least 200 people to sign a form to vouch for them getting on the ballot? And some of these districts have 40 and 50,000 people. I know some school board districts have 40 and 50,000 people. Some aldermanic districts have 48, 49, 50, 51,000 people. Some state assembly districts have 54, 55, 56,000 people. Some state senate districts have at least 150,000 people. So getting 200 or 400 or 1,500 people to sign those papers is not an insurmountable task. But in every single campaign, there's always a candidate, or it's not usually a candidate, it'll be like a volunteer that is charged with getting a certain number of signatures so that the candidate can get on the ballot. And a lot of times they'll pay people, I shouldn't call them volunteers because they're paid staffers, hey, if you get me 90 signatures of my total of 200 400 1500, whatever, I'll give you $90. I'll give you $1 per signature. This happens in every single election. It doesn't always make the news, but in every single election, there's always someone who forges and fakes signatures. Because if I'm given a stack of nomination papers with 10 blanks on them, where I got to get 10 people to fill out, you know, their name and their address, sometimes that's very hard to do. You knock on doors. Sometimes people don't answer the door. You see people out in public. Sometimes they say, no, I don't want to sign anything. And so you feel this pressure as someone who is circulating those nomination papers, because you're getting paid $1 a signature. And $1 a signature is actually low. They pay people sometimes $2 and $3 a signature. And what will happen is the person will say, well, what if I just, like, write, I'll just fill in an address. Instead of actually getting an actual human being to sign the nomination papers, they'll say, well, I'll just write. I'll use a different color pen for this one. And then for that one, I'll use a different color pen. And they won't know the difference. And, oh, I'll make up an address. And that's what they do every single time it happens. In recalls, it happens too. There are always people who want to get paid a lot of times, especially if you pay per signature, and they can't get the necessary signatures because maybe they're not skilled at it. They don't know how. They don't know how to approach people. And they just fill in signatures and erroneous addresses. Well, this happened during this most recent school board race. And I'm not, like, shaming any of the people that were involved that were, like, honest about collecting signatures, because I believe that is most of the people. But there's always folks that think they can get away with making up addresses and faking other people's signatures. And that's a crime. And it's a very, very dumb crime to get accused of, because it's just not necessary. And it's just, if you can't get the signatures, you can't get the signatures, right? So TMJ4 got a hold of the nomination pages. And I say this because, for future reference, if any of you are tasked with collecting nomination signatures, don't fake them, because they're going to get verified. Like, don't write in fake addresses and fake names. I remember this happening in the, God, what were we collecting signatures for in the 2004 presidential campaign? Were we collecting signatures so John Kerry could get on the ballot? We might have been. And so before we turn the signatures in, we, like, the campaign staff would look them over, because you can tell when stuff is fake. If there's four pages of signatures with all different names and all different addresses, but the handwriting is exactly the same, we don't even take the risk. We just discard those, because we had so many people that were out collecting signatures that you can't keep track of everybody. And some people are just there just to get a paycheck. They don't really care about actually collecting valid signatures. The Milwaukee Election Commission announced this week that the effort to recall four Milwaukee Public School Board members failed. According to the Election Commission, the group turned in 2,805 pages. However, it wasn't enough to recall any of the board members. So usually there are 10 slots per page. So if they turned in 2,805 pages, I'm going to assume that is 28,050 signatures, which is way, way short. Questions about the submitted signatures are being raised by community members and the Milwaukee Teachers Education Association. And so before people get all mad and get all angry at how MTEA has responded and how they will respond, this is the game. If you want to recall somebody from office, especially if they're supported by a union, even if that union, some of us feel, does not adequately represent the children, they represent the teachers more than they represent the children. We can have that discussion later, not now. When you try to remove somebody from office, you are starting a war. People don't take kindly to that because folks that get elected, remember, they got voted into office, so they have a whole bunch of people that obviously want them there. And so if you try to usurp the people that put them in office, people don't take kindly to that. And so MTEA has every single right. And this is a union that I'm not a supporter of, but they have every single right to fire back. And also, if they have the right to say, hey, they shot at us, they missed, they failed in this effort. But going into a recall, you have to know that if you shoot for the king and you miss, the king will be very, very angry. I'm not going to go over how it just wasn't very well thought out. And I say that because I think they wanted to recall the school board members to like show those members, haha, we can remove you from office. But if you don't have candidates lined up and at the ready that are well funded, even more funded than the people that you remove from office, you're going to lose. And it's going to set us back as a people. And I don't want black people to be set back in Milwaukee because we already have a lot of those setbacks. TMJ4 started to investigate the signatures and addresses that were submitted on August 12th. They looked at the signatures and various community members' question. They went to about 15 addresses listed on multiple pages, including 5700 West Center Street. I know that that's not a house. Absolutely, that 5700 West Center Street is not an address of a home. 3640 North 47th Street. 5041 North 46th Street, 4713 North 46th Street, 4714 North 46th Street, 4778 North 46th Street, 4522 North 46th Street. So whatever circulated that was on 46th Street. So I'm saying these addresses because they're not real or nobody lives there. If they were real people's addresses, I wouldn't be saying them because some of y'all might show up there and who knows what y'all would do. But it happens whenever someone is collecting nomination signatures and when there's a recall. There's always somebody, there's always a circulator that just makes up addresses. And you got to be really careful and really cautious because if you're a circulator of nomination papers and you're trying to get a certain number of signatures, either to get somebody on the ballot or in a recall election, you have to sign and date the bottom of the pages that you solicited. Meaning if anything on there is false, fake, or fraudulent, you are being held responsible because you signed it. You're taking responsibility for those addresses. And I don't think a lot of people know that, or they think, okay, there's 2,805 pages being collected. Well, my 10 pages of fake signatures, ain't nobody going to see that. Yes, they will. Yes, they will. MTEA and their union members and volunteers went through every single one of those pages. You will never get away with it. And I'm saying this for future reference, because there may be other recalls. There may be some of you that may take, you know, your anger and your frustration, you may decide to run for office and you're going to want to assemble a group of people to help you collect nomination signatures. You got to be cautious of this stuff. You got to tell folks if they're volunteering or if you're paying them, if somebody doesn't answer the door, do not write their name on their behalf. Don't do that. That is illegal and that's going to ruin the entire campaign. And a lot of times the candidates have no idea because they're very trusting of people that want to circulate these pages and it can totally derail somebody's legitimate campaign. Some of the addresses don't exist, and some were vacant houses. TMJ4's Megan Lee spoke with some neighbors and homeowners while trying to track down who signed the petition. Some homeowners said the name that was signed wasn't even theirs. Meanwhile, neighbors confirmed that certain addresses simply did not exist. That happens, too. And I would be very upset if somebody is circulating nomination signatures on my block and they know where I live. Because if you're a voter, your name is on all sorts of lists. So when they purchase lists of voters, they know your name and your address, whatever. And if somebody signed my name on a nomination page, I would be very, very upset. And like that happens. You guys may have heard stories about like people going through the phone book. Do they even have phone books anymore? But they would go through the phone book and just look at a name, look at an address, and they would just sign that person's name, even though they didn't approach that person, they didn't go to that person's house, they just go in the phone book just so they can fill out the nomination pages. Like that happens all of the time, or it used to when people used to get phone books. But that's just another, I guess, cautionary tale of embarking on a major political effort, which is a recall and legitimate reasons for the recall. I totally agree with the impetus of the recall. It's just the execution was sloppy. And I want to do something about that. And I've mentioned this on a bunch of occasions that we need to have a campaign training school, like an all-day retreat where you learn all of the details of how you run for office, everything from messaging and how you do digital ads and direct mail and everything you need to know about campaign finance. Because a lot of our folks run for office, they don't know anything about how campaign donations work, how you have to report them, how you have to report the money that you spend. If you give your campaign, your own money, you actually can pay yourself back, but there's a very specific way that you have to do it. And because no one instructs us on how to run these campaigns, a lot of times we do it with trial and error. But if you make an error, it can actually be a misdemeanor or a felony. So at some point, maybe we're looking at the spring of 2025. I'll let you guys know. I want to make sure I assemble people that know that are experts in all these different areas, because even if you don't run for office, you may work on a campaign, or when it is voting season or when we're in an election cycle, let me be more specific, you'll know what you're seeing. You'll know what you're hearing because it'll make sense because it would have been referenced in the campaign training school. In fact, Marina Dmitrievich, when she ran for her first elected position, she is now a member of the Milwaukee Common Council. When she first ran for the county board, and she ascended to be chairwoman of the Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors, she ran her campaign based upon the materials that she got in a campaign training class that she took that was put on by the Democratic Party many, many years ago. Because they give you like materials and PowerPoints and binders and, you know, all the details you need about how you create a campaign, how you put together a message, how you outreach to voters, et cetera, et cetera. And she literally ran her campaign out of that binder and won. And won a whole bunch of elections. She ran for mayor, though, and lost. Because, you know, she's good, but she ain't that good. But I think it could be very, very useful. And I think a lot of folks would be fantastic elected officials. They just never, like, they don't know how. They don't know where to begin. They don't know all the different steps. You got to file all these different forms. But they make it cumbersome and tedious on purpose. They make you have to read the fine print. You got to follow a set of rules and instructions. Because I don't know if we want or need people in political office that are not going to read the fine print and follow the rules and follow the instruction. Now, that's not like all they do once they get elected, but that's a significant portion of it. Like, I don't like when they create a budget and then nobody reads it. Nobody knows what's in it. I don't like when they do that. I'd imagine a county board budget has got to be several hundred pages. If you're an elected county supervisor and that is how the tax dollars collected from people in this county you're going to be spent, yo, you got to read it, because there might be stuff in there that you wouldn't want to vote for. There might be stuff in there that doesn't make any sense. There might be $300,000 dedicated to a contract that probably shouldn't even exist. So you got to be able to read the fine print. So getting on the ballot is your first exposition in reading the fine print and following a set of very tedious rules. If you want to be an elected official, I'm going to take a break, come back. Continue our chat. You're listening to The Truth with Sherwin Hughes on 101.7 FM. I'll be back in a minute.
Don't touch that dial. The Truth with Sherwin Hughes will be right back on 101.7 The Truth, The Truth app, and 1017thetruth.com.
So there will not be a recall election for any of the school board members. But here's the thing. A bunch of them are up for re-election in 2025. So just wait till like January. And so there'll be an opportunity to vote for other people if you don't like the ones who are currently in office. So I wanted to touch on that because it's a cautionary tale, because every time nomination signatures or recall signatures need to be collected, there's always some fraud. And I think it's mostly because of ignorance. People don't know that you will get caught if you make up addresses or if you forge somebody's name and then you turn in those petition signatures. So cautionary tale, I suppose. So there's something else that I wanted to clear up, something I said yesterday, which I didn't. It was simple, but complicated at the same time. It probably required more explanation from me because I was talking about, I was talking about black people. And we're not protected because we don't produce anything. And I say that kind of tongue in cheek, like we don't produce something that is so vital to America that if we didn't produce it, America would die. Like we don't create a product that is so necessary that America needs it, because if we created something that was so vital to America's safety, future, security, our economic well-being, then black people would actually be protected. People that produce are protected. I'll give you an example of an industry. Automobiles are a wonderful thing to produce. And I say that because there's a lot of countries on the planet that do not produce cars. Cars are cash cows. But having automobile production is a major, major undertaking. So we protected our automobile industry. Let me give you an example of how a car is a cash cow. You can hire people, designers, engineers, people that do the ergonomics, and you hire people who work on the assembly line to produce a vehicle. There's a lot of labor, a lot of workers, a lot of math, a lot of science, a lot of technology, a lot of computers, a lot of microchips, a lot of steel, a lot of plastic, a lot of rubber. You need a lot of iron ore. You need a lot of things from a lot of different industries to make a car. And then you get to hire all of these people and give them a wage for building that car in whatever part that they are involved in building that car. So it's a job creator. And there are other industries that survive and thrive off of all the different pieces and parts to assembling an automobile. So there's probably hundreds of industries that are fortifying themselves because there is automobile production. Then the car gets sold, right? Goes to a dealership. The dealership puts their little markup on it. The salesperson is going to make a commission. The dealership is likely going to make some profit as well from that car. So the car itself being designed and engineered and assembled, that created jobs. Now there is income being generated when that car gets sold at the dealership, or if you sell a used car, that you may not get what you paid for the car, but that is money in your pocket for the vehicle that you sold. The person that drives the car. Bunch of y'all own vehicles. You got to maintain a vehicle. You have to buy tires. You have to buy brakes. Some of you that have internal combustion engines, you have to get your oil changed. Some of you don't get your oil changed because what if you don't get your oil changed, what's that mean? You're going to be buying another car. You got to maintain a vehicle. You got to go to the mechanic. You got to go to the shop. Guess what? You got to pay them too. And the repairs that you make on maintaining your vehicle is taxed. So now the government is making money. And oh, speaking of taxes, you got to buy the gasoline for your car. You got to put the unleaded and a premium in your vehicle. Every gallon of gas that you buy is taxed, some federal, some state. So the government is making money off of that vehicle. Do you see how vital it is to protect the auto industry? Because there's so much money being generated, and I'm not even done yet. I just had to re-register my vehicle because I got the license plates on my vehicle. Some of you don't have license plates. Pandemic is over. Now you got to have plates on your vehicle. Tony Evers said, okay, because of the COVID, the DMV ain't open. You can drive around with no license plates on. Damn, COVID been over. Well, some of y'all got COVID right now. Benjamin just had COVID. I don't know where the hell he got it from. You got to register your vehicle because I have a hybrid vehicle and I don't buy gas. Wait, Benjamin has COVID again? Oh, Ricky has COVID. And I could see Ricky having COVID. Ricky looks like a COVID magnet. He looks like COVID would just like find him. So I had to register my vehicle because you don't want to get pulled over. Would y'all stop driving around with expired license plates and then getting pulled over by the cops and then saying the cop is racist? You're literally saying, please pull me over. Pull me over at the most inconvenient time, Milwaukee's finest or Milwaukee County Sheriff or State Trooper. You got to register your vehicle because maintaining roads is expensive and you got to drive on the roads, whatever. So you got to pay a registration fee. I paid $220 to register my vehicle as a driver for one damn year. And my registration fee is higher than most people's because I buy gas so infrequently that they put an extra charge on my vehicle registration because I'm not paying the gas tax. Here I am thinking I'm saving money. I mean, ultimately, I'm coming out better than most. So what month is August? Last time I got gas, I filled up because I have a, so it's a plug-in electric. So it's got a 7-gallon gas tank and then it's got a small like 4-cylinder engine, but I mostly run on electricity. Last time I filled my vehicle up was Memorial Day weekend. It's damn near fall. So I don't even know what gas prices are. I see some of y'all complain about gas price. I don't even know. Even if gas is $5 a gallon, it costs me $35 to fill my gas tank, and I'll probably have gas for the next 4 or 5 months. So it's very, very efficient. And the electricity that I use when I get home, I plug my vehicle in just into a regular outlet. It's like driving a big-ass cell phone. I just plug it in. Just charge it. It's got a charger, like a cell phone. It costs me $14 to charge my vehicle a month. So go figure. Very efficient. So because I'm not buying gas, I pay an additional, what is that, it's like $70 or something to register my vehicles. I'm paying $220 to register my vehicle. So there's an industry of creating an automobile that needs to be protected because of the number of people that are working, that are employed, the profit that is made from selling the car, and the taxes that are charged on every gallon of gas and every repair, every tire that you buy, et cetera, et cetera. African Americans don't produce anything that vital. And here in Wisconsin, we don't really rely on light rail for transportation. We rely on cars. If we have money allocated for transportation, we build more highways and we pave more roads. So cars are vital. That is an industry that needs to be protected. African Americans may work in the auto industry, but we are not an auto industry because if we were, using a metaphor, we would be protected. But as I was thinking about what I was saying yesterday about African Americans in this country not being protected because we don't produce anything, we do produce something. But it doesn't necessarily benefit us. We produce profit, but we produce profit for other people. If you rent, you're producing profit for your landlord. If you have a job, and this is something we don't often see, some of you make really good money. Some of you make so much money that you're just, I don't know, you're rich. You got a bunch of rich people out there. You're rich. You make a lot of money. But if you work for someone else, they're making more money off of you than you were making off of them. That's how business works. If your employer is only collecting $100,000 a year in revenue, you as an employee can't make $100,000 because that's all your employer is making. Sometimes employers make $1 million. You can't make $750,000 a year if your employer, the person you work for, the business, the company, the corporation is only pulling in $1 million. So even though you may be making good money, your boss, your employer, the company, the corporation is making way more off of your labor. We produce profit. We are consumers. We buy things. That's what we do. But we've always, as Black people in this country, produced profit. It used to be our very bodies that produced the profit. Now it's our labor. It's the hours that we work. It's the salaries that we collect for the work that we do. We produce profit. And if that's all we produce, then all they need is just another person to replace us. So that doesn't give us any kind of protection if the only thing that we are producing is profit because of our labor. Now, there are some exceptions, of course. There are some African-American entrepreneurs who receive the profits from other people's labor. But by and large, we are working class folk. Most Black people work until they retire. They get Social Security. They get Medicare. Maybe they have a 403B, a 401K, a Roth IRA, et cetera, et cetera. But we produce profit, meaning if immigrants come here, and this is where I suppose we should be wary, and if we need their labor, here's the thing about the United States. It is labor intensive. You got to just understand this, and this will help us all moving forward. We have to have people in this country that are working all the time in a bunch of different industries. Think about the labor that is necessary just to feed this country. the vegetables that have to be grown and picked and harvested and prepared, and they have to be shipped. We constantly need people working. We need labor all of the time. This is an extremely labor intensive nation. We need labor so bad that we really do import it from other places. Sometimes labor just flows over the border, and we're not in a rush to send them back. I think that's where the Democrats differ from the Republicans. The Republicans think if we stop them from coming over here, then Americans are going to do all those jobs. That has been debunked. It's a whole bunch of stuff y'all are not going to do that other people will. And here's the thing. We need labor. Not only do we need their labor, we also need them paying taxes. And they do pay taxes. We need them paying into Social Security and Medicare with FICA taxes. We absolutely need that. But more importantly, we need their labor. We need everybody's labor. We need what people purchase. So we make it seem like, oh, these migrants come over here and they take our jobs. Yeah, but they're also buying stuff, keeping American industries and companies profitable. We constantly need labor. Profit needs to be made all of the time. Otherwise, capitalism completely fails and falls on its face. So we, as African Americans, by and large, save for some black entrepreneurs, we don't even really control. There's one thing I suppose we do have some heavy-handed control over, and that's the black church, because a lot of times black churches are owned by black people, black parishioners, black money gets recycled through to black churches, black people are tithing. But then the black church owners is a pastor's a church owner, I guess. But then he goes and deposits his money into a white-owned bank, and then a white-owned bank may not give mortgages to the same parishioners, but they'll give it to white people with better credit scores and more down payments so those white people can gentrify the black neighborhood that the black church is in. We do control bits and pieces of our culture, like we create music and stuff, but we don't control the distribution. I can put out a mixtape. It's a very good mixtape. It's got many different songs and rhymes. I have a ballad on there. I have a couple ballads. I got a slow song. Why don't people make slow songs anymore like they used to? But I still can't. I got to put it on Spotify. So I don't even control the distribution of my music. So we do create some things, but not enough production comes from us other than our labor that is worth protecting. Take a break, come back, and then I have to demystify. White people are afraid of black people like men are afraid of women. And some of you might say, oh, us men, we're not afraid of women. Oh, yes, we are. We're afraid of them in a bunch of different ways, but it looks different how we as men exhibit our fear of women, just like when white people are afraid of us. It's not like, oh no, blacks. It often looks very different. We'll talk about that in a second. The Truth with Sherwin Hughes will be right back.
Don't touch that dial. The Truth with Sherwin Hughes will be right back on 1017 The Truth, The Truth app, and 1017thetruth.com. You are listening to The Truth with Sherwin Hughes on 1017 The Truth, The Truth app, and 1017thetruth.com.
When a majority fears a minority, you fear their progress. You fear that they may outnumber you. They may outperform you. They may replace you. If there was some regret, sadness, or sorrow after the murder of George Floyd, a lot of companies were like, oh my goodness, we need to hire more black people because black people are suffering. And they came up with all these genius DEI initiatives. We want to be intentional in recruiting more African Americans because you know what? Our company might be missing talent by not taking a closer look at black talent, because black talent looks different than white talent. And also it exists in other places, places you may not see white talent. And so some companies were very intentional and they'd hire like a DEI person, DEI director. And it was usually a black person, probably a black woman. And also it looks good. Like, oh, look what we're doing to make good on our promise to be more diverse, equitable, and inclusive. But then after a while, oh, we got too many blacks here. let's not hire anymore. And then you start questioning the performance of the ones that you did hire because you are afraid that they might actually be better than some of your other workers. That is a fear. When the majority fears, they can take from the minority. When men fear women, we fear what women can potentially do. The Me Too movement scared a lot of men because they have no idea if maybe they said something or maybe they did something that they don't remember. And a woman just all of a sudden comes out of the woodwork and accuses a man of something. And it doesn't even matter how long ago it happened. A lot of men just lost their jobs and lost their careers over doing things and saying things. Some of them don't remember. And your memory doesn't matter. If you don't remember what you said or what you did to this woman, it does not matter. If she tells her truth, you're finished. A lot of men are afraid of women. And so there was a backlash. I could say that one of the backlashes to the Me Too movement, and this is why Donald Trump is so, like, he's proud. He's proud that he selected the Supreme Court justices that overturned Roe versus Wade because it punishes women. I think Donald Trump and those like him are afraid of women, afraid of what women may do, afraid of what women may say to harm their reputations, afraid of what Stormy Daniels may say. So I got to pay her a bunch of hush money. Why? Because he was afraid of her. Fear looks a lot different because men can disguise their fear as masculinity. I'm going to tell you what. If Stormy Daniels, her name is Stephanie Clifford. Let's not call her by her porn name. I feel like that's kind of disrespectful. If she genuinely was feeling Trump and she liked him, because it happens sometimes. Sometimes married men get girlfriends. They do. It happens. It's not, you're not supposed to do that, apparently, but sometimes it happens. But if Stephanie Clifford really liked Donald Trump and he was a nice guy and she like genuinely liked him, she wouldn't have said a word. She would have humped Donald Trump for free. Hump Trump. How come nobody has coined that? Put that on a T-shirt. A Trump humper. But actually, a lot of Trump humpers are actually black men. Ooh, I made them mad with that. Oh, they're going to get mad at you, boy. Uh-oh, look who's calling. Al calling. When I say Trump humper, Al has a radar. Oh, Sharon said something about hump, and I think I need to call into the show. When men are afraid of women, it looks differently. When men are afraid of women, sometimes it looks like domestic violence. That is a man who is afraid of that woman, afraid she might leave him. I got to take a break. When I come back, we're going to talk about all of the things when men are afraid of women, like white people are afraid of black people. The Truth with Sherwin Hughes. We'll be right back.